From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a tempest in a teapot. That's how JPMorgan Chase CEO and Chairman Jamie Dimon dismissed reports of risky trading in his firm just last month. Turns out it was a very big teapot. JPMorgan Chase has lost $2 billion already in trades that Dimon himself now calls egregious. More losses may still be to come. Dimon's huge bank is backstopped by taxpayer dollars, and Dimon himself has been a leading opponent of efforts to rein in U.S. banks' high-rolling, risk-taking ways. This hour on Point, JPMorgan Chase, the London whale, and the future of bank regulation. What's your take on the JPMorgan fiasco? What needs to happen here? Will it happen? And 4 years after the great meltdown, why is all this still unresolved? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, we'll hear a little bit from Barack Obama's commencement address yesterday at Barnard College. But first, two very sharp observers of the banking world. From Jersey City, New Jersey, Matt Taibbi joins us, contributing editor for Rolling Stone. His latest book is Griftopia, story of bankers, politicians, and the most audacious power grab in American history. His famed shorthand for Wall Street and Goldman Sachs? A great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity. Matt Taibbi, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from New York is Gregory Zuckerman, financial columnist and reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He's been reporting on J.P. Morgan's trading problem since well before the story of the $2 billion loss broke last week. Author of The Greatest Trade Ever, the behind-the-scenes story of how John Paulson defied Wall Street and made financial history. Gregory Zuckerman, welcome back to you as well.
Great to be here.
I want to dig into the trades, the London whale, Voldemort, and all that with you, Gregory. You've reported on it from very early. Matt Taibbi, first to you, though. Where you've been reporting, as has Gregory, on the whole arc of what's gone on with American banking since the big meltdown at the end of 08. Where are we in that arc? Where does this moment of JPMorgan Chase's egg on its face and the unfinished business over Dodd-Frank and the Volcker Rule and all the rest, where are we in this big journey, Matt?
I think we're kind of at the same place we were 4 years ago. The history of all of this is that for most of the 20th century, we had the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated investment banks from commercial banks from insurance companies. And then we had that repealed in the late 90s, which allowed for the merger of these huge super companies like Citigroup and like JPMorgan Chase, which essentially are huge depository institutions, but also act like investment banks and hedge funds at the same time. And so what we have here with Chase is a company that was making extremely risky trades, but they're also a federally insured depository institution, which is why we care about this issue. Obviously, if they were just an investment bank and we didn't have a stake in all of this, it wouldn't really matter to most of us that they lost $2 billion making a risky trade. But they did do that, and because Dodd-Frank only theoretically addressed this, and the actual rule, the Volcker Rule that was created to address this problem, hasn't gone into effect yet. It's been delayed until 2014, so that's really the issue here.
So we're going to come back to Dodd-Frank, the Volcker Rule, all that. 2010, we saw President Obama sign it and, you know, saying, we are going to stop all the things that happened in 08, and they're never going to happen again. But you're saying, Matt Taibbi, you've been reporting, as have others, it hasn't been clinched. It's not a done deal, and lobbyists have been in there like crazy, putting the sort of salt in, or sand in the gears of the effort to regulate here.
Yeah, and there's multiple things to consider here. First of all, the Volcker Rule was heavily watered down before Dodd-Frank even got passed. They managed to negotiate a series of exemptions to the Volcker Rule. In fact, the very activity in the Chase trade was probably would have been technically legal under Dodd-Frank, from what I understand, because this trade was a hedge, and hedging activity was exempted under the Volcker Rule that they passed. There were exemptions for mutual funds, for trusts. There was a cumulative exemption. Something like 3% of a bank's Tier 1 capital, you were allowed to engage in proprietary trading. So they carved out all these different loopholes, and even so, they didn't manage to finish writing the rule on time. It was supposed to be finished by this year. And so they had to get an extension, essentially, and now it's going to be going into effect in 2014, allegedly.
All kinds of exemptions, a kind of a Swiss cheese quality there, and those pushed by, in large part, by bank lobbyists. We're going to come back and define a lot of terms. But Gregory Zuckerman in New York, you followed this latest round of trading that got JPMorgan Chase in so much trouble from very early on. Help us understand what happened here now. When you first started hearing signs of the London Whale and Voldemort and something big happening, what was it, Gregory, and what eventually unfolded here?
Sure. So in early April, I got a tip from somebody on Wall Street saying that there's a group within JPMorgan Chase that is making large, huge, risky trades. And there's one person in particular. His name is Bruno Ixel. And he's nicknamed by people in these markets the London Whale because he became such a big part of the market. I mean, he himself and his positions were bigger than about the next 10 or 20 others in that market. And these are basically derivative bets on the health of corporations. So there's an index tracking whether these companies, a group of companies, 120 or so, will default on their credit. So you can make these huge bets on them one way or the other. You can buy insurance, they're called credit default swaps. And so I first, like many, was a little bit taken aback because there's a narrative about J.P. Morgan and in particular Jamie Dimon in that they are the safest out there and the most secure bank, and they've gotten through this crisis healthier than everybody else, and surely they wouldn't take these kinds of risks. That was sort of my initial reaction. Then I did more work and I said, lo and behold, they are. And so I wrote about it in early April. And frankly, the bank was dismissive. They said, well, Jamie knows about these trades. Don't worry about them. The bank is hedging and we know what we're doing. But to me, they just seemed potentially risky. And then lo and behold, in the subsequent weeks, we realized that was the case. So we've reported the bank first came out and said $2 billion. Mm-hmm. We've reported losses of $2.3 billion. But just yesterday, we did a story saying that it's probably about $2.5 billion right now, and it could reach above $4 billion of losses.
So this was a single trader, but obviously other heads have rolled here or retired. So people looking over that shoulder, this Bruno Ixel, Voldemort, London Whale. I read somewhere he made $100 million plus, I think, last year payout on his work with J.P. Morgan Chase. And what was it that he was supposed to be doing here? Jamie Dimon has described it as hedging the bank's portfolio of all of its investments, sort of balancing out their risk. But it's and maybe the so-called Volcker rule has been watered down so much that it was cool under that rule as it kind of stands now, wherever it stands now. But this looks, a lot of people are also describing this as just a great big profit-seeking bet that puts that kind of $100 million payout in a banker's pocket, Gregory.
Yeah, well, it's unclear what he was supposed to be doing, and I'll tell you kind of my take on it is that this group, and from my reporting, we've written about this group, it's called the CIO group within J.P. Morgan. It doesn't report to the investment banking area and some other areas within the bank. It's sort of autonomous in some ways, and they have two goals. One is to hedge, to protect the bank's larger portfolio, which makes sense. You know, they're making loans left and right, or we hope they do, and their job is to protect them and hedge by doing some trading. But they're also charged with making money. And these trades, maybe now they're saying that they were an attempt at hedging. It's not clear how you define that, and that goes to the heart of the issue here. But they went beyond hedging. They went to try to make money in addition to hedging. And I do think there was some hedging element because originally this group traditionally has been sort of bearish on the markets because the bank, as a bank, is generally bullish. It makes loans and it's betting on things improving. So the job of this group is to be somewhat conservative and protective and bearish, but they got away from that. And they basically started making bets on corporate health, in particular Bruno Ixel. He made a huge bet that corporate debt would improve in quality.
Matt Taibbi, how do you see what happened here? It may have technically snuck in under these Swiss-cheesed Volcker rules, but is this an example of your vampire squid relentlessly jamming its blood funneled into anything that smells like money, Matt?
You know, this kind of reminds me a little bit of the AIG episode, and Gregory probably knows more about this than I do, but, you know, in that episode, what you had was you had a huge relatively conservative insurance company that had one unit within it, AIGFP, which was also based in London, that was making these huge derivative bets. And if I'm not mistaken, and Greg can probably correct me if I'm wrong here, I think they were kind of doing the same thing. They were selling credit protection, and I think they were just they ended up with a huge bet. In that case, it was on mortgages, and in this case, it was on corporate bonds that just got out of control. And I think this is the danger of sort of the modern financial services industry, is that especially when derivatives are involved, you just end up with these sort of giant nuclear power positions that if they go wrong, they go really wrong. And I think sometimes even the risk assessment people in these companies, they're just not always fully aware of what all the different consequences are of all these different positions. And that's what's so dangerous, is that we've found out over and over again over the years that the companies themselves are not good enough at assessing their own risk. And so when things go wrong, they just go wrong in a way that nobody anticipates.
And JPMorgan Chase was supposed to be the best. I mean, Matt, isn't this exactly where we weren't supposed to be 4 years after the meltdown?
Yeah, no, we definitely did not want to be here, but we never really came close to addressing this problem after the crash.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about JPMorgan Chase's $2 billion fiasco, gamble and loss, and the fight over tighter regulation for American banks. Gregory Zuckerman is with us from the Wall Street Journal, financial columnist and reporter there. He was all over the so-called London whale, Voldemort, way before JPMorgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon came out last week and said, hey, we've got a problem here. He's author of The Greatest Trade Ever. Matt Taibbi is here, contributing editor for Rolling Stone, author of Griftopia. He's been writing about all this. His Rolling Stone blog titled Jamie's Crying. Here was Jamie Dimon back in February on the Fox Business Network criticizing plans for the so-called Volcker Rule to keep banks from playing around with maybe your money in quite this way. Elements of the rule weren't necessary, he said, and could unduly restrict banks from hedging and market making.
We don't make huge bets. So I understand the goal to make sure these companies don't take huge bets in their balance sheets, but market making, just like these stores down the street, when they buy a lot of polka dot dresses, they hope they're going to sell. They're making a judgment call. They may be wrong. So protecting the system, I agree with. But you know, starting to talk about the intent, I tell you, every trader, we're going to have a lawyer, compliance officer, doctor to see what their testosterone levels are, and shrink. What's your intent?
We don't make big bets, said the CEO, Jamie Dimon, back in February. Well, not true. They did, and they lost big. Here he was on NBC's Meet the Press with David Gregory on Sunday talking about the big loss.
We took a $2 billion loss, and we made it clear it could get worse before it gets better. You know, it could be volatile by $1 billion, possibly. I do want to put in perspective, the company is going to earn a lot of money this quarter. And so it's a very strong company. We made a terrible, egregious mistake. There's almost no excuse for it.
Terrible, egregious mistake, this Jamie Dimon now says. Matt Taibbi and Gregory Zuckerman are with us. Bill's calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. And pardon me if I stumble over my tongue. I had gum surgery yesterday.
Good to know.
There was an article in the New York Times this weekend in the Sunday or Weekly Review, and the title of it is Capitalists and Other Psychopaths. And midway through the article, by the way, there's a caption in here that says, rich people are more likely to lie, cheat, and break the law. No surprise. Now, the gentleman who was arguing for a relaxation or no control over this particular market, we're not talking about an insurance market, by the way. We're talking about gambling here. This is an example of a person, and these are examples of people who definitely need to be reined in by things like Glass-Steagall, by the Dodd-Frank rule. Personally, I'd like to go back to Glass-Steagall. Capitalism has always needed to be saved from itself. And I gave your screen of two examples. One was Theodore Roosevelt, who broke down the trusts, and one was Franklin Roosevelt, who definitely saved capitalism from itself. I mean, we're talking about a time when capitalism was threatened by very, very extreme groups, like the Communist Party, the American Nazi Party. I mean,
and a meltdown right there on Wall Street. Bill, let us pick it up. And Gregory, I'll bring that to you. But Matt, take us back just by way of comparison, because you look back to FDR and what happened in just a couple of years after he came in a very similar circumstances to Barack Obama, to a great big Wall Street mess at the beginning of his time in office. Give us a little comparison then and now, Matt.
Yeah, it was a very similar situation. FDR came in after a huge speculative bubble had been run up and had burst, after there had been an enormous amount of speculation in relatively unregulated markets. And what FDR did is he just essentially created a whole bunch of new rules for the game. Stocks had to be traded on open, regulated exchanges. You had to have some information and some regular disclosures about every stock that was every publicly traded stock, and then there was the Commodity Exchange Act, which created regulated exchanges for the trading of commodities. Obama came in and he had pretty much the same situation, and his opportunity was to do all of that same kind of work with, say, the derivatives market, and that's kind of what they didn't do. Dodd-Frank intended to create some more transparency and to force banks to retain more capital and to also protect federally insured institutions from risky gambling activity. But they really just didn't go whole hog the way that FDR did, and they did a lot of half measures, and that's kind of why we're in the situation we're in now.
So here we are. Gregory Zuckerman, can you define a couple of terms for us? Our caller talks about Glass-Steagall and the Volcker Rule. I mean, he's got a perspective on what's going on here that I think a lot of Americans, you know, somewhere in the back of their minds are wondering about these days. But those two, what was Glass-Steagall? Why was it put aside? And how about the Volcker Rule? Will it be a substitute for that, a bulwark like that?
Well, Glass-Steagall was aimed at separating the different endeavors of banks, both lending and investing and trading. And in terms of the Volcker Rule,
but the point of it was so that Ma and Pa Kettle wouldn't see their money sort of flying off into some speculative realm when all they did was take it to the bank and think they were keeping it safe there, right?
Right. And we as taxpayers wouldn't have to bail out banks or prop them up as we did just a few years ago.
And that was taken away at the end of the 90s.
Right. And the Volcker Rule is aimed at eliminating risky trading by banks and investment banks with their own money. The difficulty is, and it's not just a question of those evil lobbyists and those evil banks, mm-hmm. It is a tough definition. What is risky trading? So let me make the argument of a Jamie Dimon would make or someone in that world. Mm-hmm. Right now, there's a troubled company called Chesapeake Energy, the second largest natural gas company out there. There are insurance companies and mutual funds and such who own a lot of the debt of Chesapeake, mm-hmm. and they want to sell it right now. So if you go to Wall Street and you want to sell a lot of debt, hey, I'm scared, I want to get rid of this thing, a trader has to buy it from you. And the trader doesn't have somebody to sell it to right away. Now, we don't want to restrict the trader and eliminate that kind of transaction, because the insurance company will never take a chance on buying mm-hmm. the corporate debt of a troubled company in the future. So that's why it's difficult for regulators and that's why there's a back and forth on how to define risky trading. So is the Goldman Sachs trader who buys $100 million of Chesapeake Energy debt doing a risky trade that we want to outlaw? And what if it blows up? It's all subject to debate. I would argue, and when I heard about this.
If we may, let Matt come in, and Gregory, I'll come right back to you. Matt, what do you say there?
I just would say that it would be very easy to regulate if the trader wasn't also a commercial bank. I mean, by all means, let the trader make that trade, but as long as he's not a commercial bank that's, you know, borrowing money from the discount window at the Federal Reserve. I think Glass-Steagall addressed that question very, very simply. It just created a wall between all these different kinds of activities and just said, hey, you're perfectly you should be allowed to do that trade. As long as there's no public money at risk.
Gregory, what about putting some walls back up so that we don't have this sort of sloshing back and forth between public money and the banker's, you know, private interests?
Well, the problem is everybody's a commercial bank now. I mean, Goldman Sachs and others became.
Because Glass-Steagall came down. Maybe we put it back up and redefine boundaries a little bit here.
Well, they also did get cheap money from the government, from you and me, unfortunately. I mean, I would argue that there is some line. It's sort of like the pornography and, you know, Justice Brandeis. This kind of trading is obviously something we do not want a bank to have to be doing. They're taking risks and they're doing it with taxpayer backstop. So we don't want that. I just am making the argument mm-hmm. that there is a gray area as well.
But why leave the gray area there if we fall back into it again and again? Why not bring back Glass-Steagall? The vocal rule itself is a kind of version of Glass-Steagall. Why not have bright, clear lines here, Gregory? Would it hurt us somehow? We've seen the pain that comes, the cost that comes to taxpayers and a lot of others from having the gray area.
Listen, you can make an argument that you roll things back. It's not clear how you do that. You could potentially do that. And frankly, we haven't really discussed about the issue of too big to fail. I mean, by definition, J.P. Morgan Chase is a too big to fail bank, and we thought we learned that lesson a few years ago. We don't want those kind of institutions to be so crucial in the economy, and clearly we are. So, you know, they would argue that, well, how do we break up J.P. Morgan Chase? But, you know, the people at AT&T said the same kind of thing a few years ago, so there probably are ways to do it.
Matt Taibbi, after the big meltdown in 08, I mean, we maybe naively, but I think people thought, look, this was terrible. We almost had a global complete meltdown here. We got out by the skin of our teeth. It was bad, and we're still paying the price for it. Surely responsible parties are going to take this off and fix it. What happened to the effort to get this fixed, to get some bright lines redrawn here, Matt, so that we wouldn't live with this cliff of uncertainty and risk and, you know, private profit seekers taking the whole country down with them?
Well, I think Greg kind of hit the nail on the head. The main problem was the too big to fail issue. And it's not – people need to understand, it's not just that these banks are too big. It's also that they're too interconnected. It's impossible to allow a company like a J.P. Morgan Chase or a Citigroup, if they do fail, we can't just let them fail. We have to step in and do something because they would ruin the entire economy. There would be a catastrophic event.
So why haven't they been broken up? You've got, you know, very sober-minded bankers in the Midwest I'm reading here saying, break them up, change the amount of percent of GDP that's in the hands of just a few banks and bring some bright lines back.
Absolutely. I mean, I completely agree. We need it's a matter of national security. We need to break up these companies immediately, and I don't even think there's any question about it. But these companies are extremely powerful. They have extremely powerful lobbying organizations. I mean, when I was covering the Dodd-Frank negotiations, there were so many lobbyists in Congress that I didn't have a place to sit while I was waiting for an interview with one of the senators on the banking committee. There are just so many of them, and there's nobody on the other side. There's a couple of small organizations that lobby for reform, but they're outnumbered by about 200, 300 to 1 by banking lobbyists, and that's why this stuff hasn't gotten done.
Tyler in New York, Saratoga, New York. Tyler, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, I just wanted to comment and say I think it's really going to actually take some sort of real economic collapse or some way for these huge banks to lose all their money. So therefore, they wouldn't have all these lobbyists in Congress to keep the company together. And that's the only way they're going to be able to get them to break up.
But that's pain for everybody. I hope you're wrong. I mean, you might be right, but I mean, maybe he is right, Greg. I mean, here you've got Jamie Dimon. He sits on the board of directors of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. He's right there in the policymaking, you know, wheelhouse. At the same time, they're supposed to be, you know, watching over his shoulder.
Well, we had a pretty tough downturn, and we don't want something nearly as bad. So I'm not sure I would welcome that. I should note, though, that things are better. I would argue things are better than a few years ago. We're not where we should be, but banks have more capital. That's not just our rules. There's a Basel rule. So banks are sitting on more capital, which I think is crucial. And there are fewer people doing this kind of trading up and down Wall Street.
Are you sure? Because one of the things that emerged here was, I mean, you kind of knew. You had a heads up from insiders, but most of us didn't know. It seems like a lot of people didn't. It seems like Jamie Dimon may not have entirely understood what was happening.
Yeah, that's among the most troubling issues of this whole thing. I mean, the timeline here is we wrote a story. And then Jamie Dimon rolled up his sleeves and his team rolled up his sleeves to take a look at it. That just scared me as a taxpayer and as a citizen.
Let's go to Lexington, Kentucky, and David. David, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Tom. How are you doing today?
I'm all right. What's your perspective?
Well, sir, I listen to you quite often, and I appreciate you playing devil's advocate. I hope you're playing devil's advocate. I happen to be, my wife and I, semi-retired, and we make bets on that big crap table called the stock market.
Okay.
And we do hold underlying stock at J.P. Morgan, and we've recently placed some call bets on it.
So you've taken a little bit of a hit in the last few days. How do you look at everything then?
I don't know. It looks like we're going to do pretty good as soon as this thing gets out of the news and Congress gets out of the way. I just want to bring up to the fact, and if it helps any, I don't know. I hold a degree in economics with a minor in accounting.
Good.
From back in 1968, for whatever that's worth.
Yep.
I do understand the system pretty well. This is not public money. It's a very well-run company. And that $2 billion, well, you know, that's less than 0.5% of the money, the personal money that J.P. Morgan had to play with, if you will.
David, let us pick it up. We're coming up to the break, so let us pick it up, and I appreciate your call. Matt Taibbi, how about it? A, not public money, and B, and Jamie Dimon has said something similar. It's a lot of money, but it's just not that much money in J.P. Morgan's world, so on both counts, let's settle down here. What do you say, Matt?
Okay, well, when there was an audit of the Federal Reserve, which was part of the Dodd-Frank law, we found out that there was $16 trillion in emergency lending that the Fed had done in the last 4 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
J.P. Morgan Chase had received $390 billion of not quite zero, but definitely below market loans from the Federal Reserve. So there's an enormous amount of very, very cheap public money that goes to J.P. Morgan Chase. The bank also was the recipient of numerous bailouts. It got $29 billion in guarantees from the Fed to buy Bear Stearns. It got another $25 billion in bailouts after the 2008 crisis, which it used to help buy Washington Mutual. And then even bigger than that is if J.P. Morgan Chase collapses, we're going to pay for it. I mean, it's not that the FDIC is going to be equal to the task of bailing out that institution. They are going to take taxpayer money in one form or another to rescue that company if it collapses. So it's definitely, there's a lot of public money at stake.
Gregory Zuckerman, and what about the $2 billion and maybe more? Jamie Dimon says maybe another billion. Others are saying it could be $5 billion. But are you confident this is all a containable, manageable volume of losses here in J.P. Morgan and beyond?
Well, I guess it is not a big chunk of their profits that they made, about $19 billion last year. But the issue here is, again, it could be $4 billion or more. It's not contained. We don't know where the end is. It could be less. It could be more. It's actually quite fascinating because in past kind of rogue and other kinds of trading fiascos, firms own up to the losses after they're out of their positions. They're not out of these positions yet, which I find kind of interesting.
Wow. Gregory Zuckerman in New York, please stand by with The Wall Street Journal. Matt Taibbi with us from Jersey City. Listeners, we're talking about J.P. Morgan Chase and everything it's up against here. Jamie Crian, Van Halen sang, and it's the title of Matt Taibbi's blog post at Rolling Stone. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about J.P. Morgan Chase's $2 billion, maybe more to come, fiasco, gamble and loss, and the fight over tighter regulation for American banks. There's been a lot of tussling over it in Washington since the meltdown in 08, and it is still not resolved. This big announcement of a $2 billion loss has put new heat around that. We'll see where it goes. Gregory Zuckerman is with us this hour, columnist, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Matt Taibbi is here, contributing editor for Rolling Stone. They've both written a lot about this. Gregory, in particular, followed very early on the London whale, Voldemort, some are calling him, with the huge trades that got J.P. Morgan Chase in trouble here. Lots of response online. Some saying, look, banks, let them act however they want, but get them out of the publics here. Listener says, we need strong regulation for banks protected by FDIC and too big to fail. If J.P. Morgan wants to make risky, unregulated investments, let them, but no government protections and required clear presentation to investors. He says, the problem with the current system is the myth that you can run regulated and unregulated commerce in the same business and retain the same safety of the regulated side, which is nonsense. Don't straitjacket these businesses. But if they want to fly without a net, then let them fly without a net. What do you say to that, Gregory Zuckerman?
I think the key, and Matt made this point earlier, is how crucial banks are to the overall economy. They're just a different type of trading institution. A hedge fund loses $2 billion. We don't care and we shouldn't care too much as long as we as taxpayers don't have to get involved. I also think there's an element of hubris here. I mean, I've talked to people within this group who are close to these trades, and they honestly didn't think they were taking on huge risks. And I'm not in any way backing them up. I'm supporting that view. I think they thought this was somewhat of a hedging, somewhat of a relatively safe transaction, which blew up. But it just is sort of on a personal level, just a huge reminder that 4 years after the crisis, there's still such hubris in this industry.
Matt, do we have to stay exposed to this part of the banking business? Gregory points out the banks, of course, are important for the economy, but we didn't see this kind of vulnerability for decades and decades after the reforms of the 30s. Do we have to just sit here in this position again for some reason?
No, we don't, but it would be an enormous chore to separate all of these institutions. So, you know, back in the day when insurance companies and banks and investment banks were separate, you know, we didn't have this kind of problem. But now all of these companies are hugely interconnected, especially with the derivatives trades. If one company takes a huge hit, or if one of them collapses, it can set off a chain reaction of losses that spans the entire economy.
But that's my point. We act like we're stuck with this status quo, but it's public money backstopping here, so there should be a public say. I mean, why not disentangle it? You say it's a big chore. It's a big chore digging out from the kind of meltdown we had in 08. That's a big chore, too.
I completely agree with you, and I completely agree that we have to do it. I'm just saying that it's both politically and logistically an enormous undertaking to take J.P. Morgan Chase and make it not a dangerous company. It's a lot more complicated than it sounds. It would take years and years and years and a lot of political will to get it done, and we're just far away from that.
What about, today, I guess, as we speak at this very hour, J.P. Morgan Chase shareholders are going to be, if not already, grilling Jamie Dimon in Tampa. What about the shareholders themselves stepping up to do something here, Gregory? I mean, here's Jamie Dimon with his, 23 million compensation they're going to be looking at. Ina Drew, who retired under fire here, 14, 15 million last year. Your London Whale, maybe a $100 million payout. Will shareholders turn on those things and do something about it with Dimon, let's say, or not?
Yeah, I'm doubtful. I mean, frankly, he's done well, relatively speaking, over the past few years. Part of the reason being that J.P. Morgan was sort of an afterthought in some of the hot areas in the era 2005 through 2008 area, so it never got into some of the lucrative areas that blew up on people like Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch. But he's done relatively well, and he's built up some political capital within his firm and with shareholders as well. I think he'll get yelled at a lot today. I think he'll get critiqued. But I think it will take more than this to affect some real change there.
Christine in Columbia, South Carolina. Thank you for calling, Christine. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I was wondering how this is going to affect just your regular old average American. My husband and I are 40. We invest in our 401ks. We live frugally. We've never gotten involved in buying a home that was too expensive. We feel like we do everything right.
Mm-hmm.
And then we hear about this, and it's scary, and you don't know exactly but what the effects are going to be. What do you think it's going to do to someone like us who we try and do the right thing, and then this comes up, and what's going to happen?
I'm glad you ask it just that way, Christine. Matt Taibbi, connect the dots a little bit. You know, there's a Christine and her husband looking to do the right thing, putting some money away, not extending themselves too far, and yet feeling vulnerable when they hear about all this. What is their exposure?
Well, if you go back to 2008, ordinary people felt the sting of this in a number of different ways. Probably the first and foremost thing was that their tax dollars went to bailing out a lot of these institutions. But there are a lot of more subtle ways that people are affected by all this. When the crash happened and the Fed decided to try to stimulate the economy by slashing interest rates to zero, we were left in a situation where banks essentially got their money for free from the government, but people who had done all the right things and had saved their money over the years and were putting their money in their bank accounts, or elderly people who had CDs and were retiring were depending on that retirement income to live on, suddenly they were earning a lot less because they weren't getting the same interest that they were getting before. So these, you know, when you have a situation where there's this kind of bailout economy where the banks have basically limitless access to free capital from the government, and ordinary people have to pay market rates, it creates this inherent unfairness in the system that I think permeates the entire economy and I think is behind a lot of this discontent that people feel right now.
Lori in Middlebury, Vermont. Lori, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Now, along with the last caller, I'm wondering, was there anything done after the issue 4 years ago to make it, you know, a little bit harder, or were there any stipulations set forth before this public money was available to the banks?
Matt, let me come back to you on that, and then Gregory as well. But what you write a lot about how much has been stonewalled and not done. But Dodd-Frank was passed. It had a lot of regulations that were to be filled in later. You know, what has been done? What remains to be done, Matt? Or is it clear what's going to happen here at all?
Well, Dodd-Frank did sort of address some of these issues, but it really left a lot of the bigger issues unresolved. The biggest one was that it just left these companies intact. They had an opportunity to break up these too big to fail companies. There was an amendment in the Senate called the Brown-Kaufman Amendment that would have broken up a company like Chase, made it into smaller, less dangerous companies. That got walloped in the Senate by both parties. There was a mechanism they put in place to wind down failing companies that really had all the teeth taken out of it. And in fact, the House has just voted to eliminate that entire portion of the bill. The Volcker rule has been delayed till 2014. The derivatives portion of the bill has been pumped full of holes, and then there's a whole wave of bills coming through the House right now that would sink basically that entire section of Dodd-Frank. So anything that they did to try to address these problems, you know, there very little of those ideas has really survived through now.
You've got here's a little clip from Elizabeth Warren, who was head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or got it started there, was involved in the overseeing TARP to make sure that went right. She talked yesterday with CNN about the J.P. Morgan Chase losses and what has gone on with efforts to get more oversight of U.S. banks. Here's Warren.
This isn't personal to Jamie Dimon. It's what's been going on ever since Dodd-Frank passed. There's been a guerrilla war out there in which the largest financial institutions have been doing everything they can to make sure that financial regulations don't get it put in place, and if they do get put in place, that they're loaded with loopholes and not very effective.
Loaded with loopholes, and a lot of work has gone into making that happen. Now, Gregory, this is all, you know, back on the front burner right now, and Jamie Dimon unhappy about that because this news has come out just when there's a lot of attention on the Volcker rule in particular. Do you think that this may, the news of the last several days may change the course of what Congress does, or is this, you know, maybe in the end he's right, tempest in a teapot, only in the sense that after a few days people go back up to their knitting and the lobbyists go back to their work and, you know, it won't be tough after all?
Well, we're at an interesting juncture here where we're actually close to a final language on Volcker. So as he said, J.P. Morgan couldn't have picked the worst time to have this fiasco. So I think it will affect language of the Volcker rule. So at the margin, people will do less of this on Wall Street. I also want to note that there are embedded regulators at banks now. So it's not just a question of, oh, we need more regulators. Those guys make mistakes just as frequently as people in the private industry do. They miss the Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke missed the financial meltdown. And it could be that people within the banks, regulators, also miss these trades too. To me, the lesson, the answer is that banks should be sitting on more capital. They fought that, and Basel is forcing them to set aside more capital. Maybe even more capital should be set aside. And also clawbacks. I mean, these people, it's not clear yet whether the traders will have to give back some of their pay or all their pay. You know, we need more restrictions on those kinds of things.
The London Whale off with this $100 million. What do you think, Matt? Are we likely to see, with this little bonfire lighting things up a bit, tougher language in the Volcker Rule, or still a lot of wiggle room?
I think we might see some language initially, but the history of the Volcker Rule is that you get a strong position to begin with, and then it gets whittled down either in new legislation that comes through the House or in lawsuits, or they lean on the regulators. One of the things that they've been doing lately is you'll have a bunch of Republican congressmen threaten to take the funding away from the SEC or the CFTC while those agencies are in the middle of writing these rules. And so they tend to preemptively make the rules weaker to concede to those same congressmen. So they have all these different avenues of weakening these rules. And what tends to happen is that the politicians who called for stronger regulation, once they get the headline of getting something passed, they don't follow through and make sure that it stays passed. And so I have serious doubts that we'll see tougher regulations because of this.
Citizens, pay attention. It's your economy. Matt Taibbi with Rolling Stone, or what we'd like to hope so. Matt Taibbi, thank you very much. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
And Gregory Zuckerman at the Wall Street Journal. Terrific to have you, Gregory. Thanks for your time.
Great to be here.
In a moment, President Obama's advice for 2012 graduates at Barnard College. This is On Point. Yesterday, President Barack Obama delivered what will be his only college commencement address in 2012 at Barnard College, the all-women's school in New York City. The president reaffirmed his commitment to women's issues and told the nearly 600 young female graduates to reach high and hope deeply.
After decades of slow, steady, extraordinary progress, you are now poised to make this the century where women shape not only their own destiny, but the destiny of this nation and of this world. But how far your leadership takes this country, how far it takes this world, well, that will be up to you. You've got to want it. It will not be handed to you. And as someone who wants that future, that better future for you and for Malia and Sasha, as somebody who's had the good fortune of being the husband and the father and the son of some strong, remarkable women, allow me to offer just a few pieces of advice. That's obligatory. Bear with me. My first piece of advice is this. Don't just get involved. Fight for your seat at the table. Better yet, fight for a seat at the head of the table. It's been said that the most important role in our democracy is the role of citizen. And indeed, it was 225 years ago today that the Constitutional Convention opened in Philadelphia, and our founders, citizens all, began crafting an extraordinary document. Yes, it had its flaws, flaws that this nation has strived to protect over time. Questions of race and gender were unresolved. No women's signature graced the original document, although we can assume that there were founding mothers whispering smarter things in the ears of the founding fathers. I think that's almost certain. What made this document special was that it provided the space, the possibility for those who had been left out of our charter to fight their way in. It provided people the language to appeal to principles and ideals that broadened democracy's reach. It allowed for protest and movements and the dissemination of new ideas that would repeatedly, decade after decade, change the world. A constant forward movement that continues to this day. Our founders understood that America does not stand still. We are dynamic, not static. We look forward, not back. And now that new doors have been opened for you, you've got an obligation to seize those opportunities. You need to do this not just for yourself, but for those who don't yet enjoy the choices that you've had, the choices you will have. And one reason many workplaces still have outdated policies is because women only account for 3% of the CEOs at Fortune 500 companies. One reason we're actually refighting long-settled battles over women's rights is because women occupy fewer than 1 in 5 seats in Congress. Now, I'm not saying that the only way to achieve success is by climbing to the top of the corporate ladder or running for office, although, let's face it, Congress would get a lot more done if you did. That, I think, we're clear about. But if you decide not to sit yourself at the table, at the very least, you've got to make sure you have a say in who does. It matters.
President Obama speaking to 2012 graduates at Barnard College in New York yesterday. To watch a video of his address and for a full transcript, go to our website, onpointradio.org. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.